Robert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mueller, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mueller Program. It's Friday. It is February the 15th, 2008. And right now, standing as we are at this point in the history of the year unfolding with the presidential election before us, it's really clear that Americans are beginning to rethink many aspects of what they had expected politically. And just in the last 24 hours or so, it is clear that Barack Obama on the Democratic side is charging with momentum, especially right now in the state of Wisconsin. They'll have its primary coming on Tuesday. Even as yesterday, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney had endorsed Arizona Senator John McCain. So it's really interesting to watch how this is all coming about. And yet, even as the presidential election has the headlines right now, and inevitably so, probably even deservedly so, there are other important issues in the headlines as well. We're going to look to those as we think about what Christians ought to have on our minds today. Certainly, our minds ought to be directed towards the tragedy in DeKalb, Illinois, where 7 persons have died, including 6 victims and a gunman who shot himself after another killing spree, this one on a college campus at Northern Illinois University. Now, of course, what you have coming again and again and again with this, and by the way, there are 17 others, according to some press reports, who were injured, 15 seriously so. When you start looking at this, you realize that people begin to ask two very specific questions. Number one, how could anyone do this? And as difficult as the answer must be to say, the answer is the human beings are capable of incredible evil. Human beings are fragile persons, fragile individuals, when it comes to even moral rationality at times. And it's clear that under the surface of many persons who can look normal, next to you on the bus, in the car next to you on the road, walking beside you or across from you in the mall, there lurks behind many peaceful facades a great deal of violence. That's a hard thing for human beings to recognize, but Christians, again, we need to remember we live in a Genesis 3 world, a world in which sin is not only deadly, but also deceitful. We also need to realize that this tells us something about certain patterns of human sinfulness. Not only, of course, is there the pattern of great premeditated evil here, a man who carried 3 weapons into a place where he knew there would be innocent, vulnerable people, innocent in the sense that they had done nothing. Nothing whatsoever that would even bring a shred of rationality to this attack. And he went in with premeditated intent to kill first others and then himself. But this tells us something else about human patterns of sin, and that is that we are not that creative. In other words, one of the scariest aspects of all of this is that human beings tend to be copycat sinners. Evidently, right now, those who would do such things believe that somehow, even with a twisted rationality, it makes sense for them to try to make some kind of statement in just this way. And you obviously have a great deal of borrowing here. You can start looking at all the campus shootings and killings that have gone on in recent years, even in recent months, especially since Virginia Tech last year. You can start looking at the kinds of attacks that come. Also, when you're looking at world terrorism with the suicide bombings and all the rest, people are not that creative. We tend even to be copycat sinners. And that's another issue of warning to us. Christians, we're the people who are supposed to know that sin is not only deadful, but it is deceitful. And it's not only deceitful, it also demonstrates the sheer, well, I don't know any better way to put it than imbecility of what patterns of sin reveal themselves to be. People who are desperate to do desperately sinful things will do them and often will copy what others have done in order to do them. Our hearts should go out, and certainly we should be praying for those families that have suffered loss in Illinois, and especially for those 15 right now who are hanging on for life after this murderous attack. There are some other things in the news that are almost difficult to believe. For instance, a report in the Washington Times today saying that a new study, a survey reveals that 6th graders with boyfriends and girlfriends have become something of a norm. Middle schoolers are now going on dates. This new national survey that was taken of 1,043 tweenagers, or tweens, that's children between the ages of 11 to 14. The study was done by the National Domestic Violence Hotline and Liz Claiborne Incorporated, found that 30% of young teens think oral sex and sexual intercourse are expected in a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship. Hundreds of the tweens, and when you're dealing with a study that included just 1,043, when you're talking about hundreds, that's a very large percentage of the sample, reported that their dating partners have harassed them, bossed them around, or tried to monopolize their time. A few even reported physical abuse, hitting, slapping, kicking, or being pressured into having oral sex or intercourse. Cheryl Gates, chief executive of the National Domestic Violence Hotline, said, "We're talking about a whole new cycle of abuse." Now, here is the thing that must be first on our minds. This is nuts. It's absolute insanity that you would have parents allowing children this age to date. I have, and if you've been listening to this program for some time, this is no news, I have significant concerns about the entire dating culture when it comes to older teenagers and even to young adults. But when you talk about a dating culture for tweenagers, for children as young as 11, 12, 13, 14, you're talking about a setup for the very kind of pattern of abuse and violation and early sexualization and all the rest that's going on here. It leads to the obvious question that must be on our minds at so many different turns when we read the headlines in this society, and that is, where are the parents and why are parents not parenting? What kind of parent would think it would make sense to allow these young tweens to be in dating and romantic relationships? While reading things that hardly seem possible and yet are, we also go to Washington, D.C., where another report comes out telling us that Foundry United Methodist Church in the District of Columbia has announced that it will recognize same-sex unions, will commemorate them in special ceremonies, becoming one of only a handful of Methodist congregations now doing so. The February newsletter of Foundry United Methodist Church says the nearly 200-year-old church will host services that honor same-sex unions that, in the words of the release, quote, include testimonials from their friends and loved ones, end quote. Dean Snyder, who's a senior pastor of the church, said, "It's an attempt to be ecclesiastically obedient while at the same time offering pastoral care to our members." Now, what's really interesting is that if you're talking about being ecclesiastically obedient here, what it means is falling short of calling this marriage. That's all it means. It's not even a claim, by the way, at being biblically obedient. Trying to find a way to do whatever we can do, according to this church, to accommodate the homosexual movement without actually having to call something homosexual marriage. The newsletter of the church describes Foundry United Methodist as having a large gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender membership, and the church as being a leader in making the United Methodist Church more inclusive. Now, if you're familiar with this church, you would be familiar with the former pastor, the Reverend Philip Wagaman, who was one of the most liberal ethicists and theologians in the United Methodist Church until his retirement. He, by the way, is very pleased with this. He calls the new policy courageous and insightful. There is no particular news about what two of the most famous attendees of this church think, because during their presidency, it's hard to know even how to describe this, the administration of former President Bill Clinton, both Bill and Hillary Clinton attended Foundry United Methodist Church. Mrs. Clinton, now Senator Clinton, is, of course, a member of the United Methodist Church. This was the church she attended during their previous years in Washington. Other issues in the news include the fact that Patricia Cohen of the New York Times has written a column entitled "Dumb and Dumber, Are Americans Hostile to Knowledge?" Now, something that's interesting about this is the fact that Susan Jacoby has a new book out. This new book has to do with what Americans don't know. I have the book. It's very interesting, as a matter of fact. And as is everything she does, I have debated her in different contexts. But she's got a new book coming out suggesting Against Reason, and the title of her book is The Age of American Unreason, that Americans lost the ability to think. They were not all that intelligent anymore. And, of course, this is an accusation that comes from both the left and the right in different ways. But the left is very common to be found to suggest that it just is so, that if you want to look at America and try to figure out why so many Americans believe in do not believe in evolution, why so many Americans believe in Christianity, why so many Americans vote conservative, as a matter of fact, it's because they must be unintelligent. That's Susan Jacoby's point. Well, I'm certainly going to differ with her thesis, but it's sometimes difficult to differ with some of her anecdotes. She talks about being in New York City, where she heard a conversation between two men, one of whom referring to the 2001 event 9/11 said, it's just like Pearl Harbor. The other asked, what is Pearl Harbor? The first man said, that was when the Vietnamese dropped bombs in a harbor and it started the Vietnam War. At that point, Susan Jacoby said, I decided to write this book. Well, you know what? I wouldn't have written that book, not her book, but if I'd heard that conversation, I might have decided to write a book as well. What Americans Don't Know and Why It Will Hurt You. When we come back, we're going to be talking about something that's fascinating, a classic conversation with the Albert Mueller program, in which you're going to hear the secular left accuse those who believe in creationism as being a threat to the future of the culture, civilization itself. Fascinating conversation coming up next. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. You're listening to the Albert Mueller program.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller program.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller program. It's one of those stories which, when you see it, you just have to wonder if it could really be real. But it is real. Major news sources and the official website of the Council of Europe are trumpeting the fact that that organization last week adopted a resolution stating that creationism is a threat to human rights and that it is promoted by, quote, forms of religious extremism. Reuters, one of the major European news sources, reported the council, based in the eastern French city of Strasbourg, oversees human rights standards in member states and enforces decisions of the European Court of Human Rights. The resolution, which passed 48 votes to 25 with three abstentions, is not binding on the council's 47 member states, but reflects widespread opposition among politicians to teaching creationism in science class. All right. Very helpfully, the Council of Europe has a great website, very useful website, in which they actually post the resolution, which is available for all to see. If you go to my website at albertmueller.com, you'll find my article entitled, Is Creationism a Threat to Human Rights? And just follow the hyperlink directly to the resolution. Let me just read to you some from the resolution. It's absolutely fascinating. I mean, this group is saying that creationism is a threat to human rights. It's a threat to democracy. And that it inevitably would lead to theocracy. This is what they said. The Parliamentary Assembly is worried about the possible ill effects of the spread of creationist ideas within our education systems and about the consequences for our democracies. If we are not careful, creationism could become a threat to human rights, which are a key concern of the Council of Europe. That sentence is preceded by this. For some people, the creation, as a matter of religious belief, gives a meaning to life. Okay, you know, you look at that and you just have to say, we must have just looked at the future. And in the future, if the secularized culture of Europe is the future we're supposed to be looking at, in that secular future, you've got to tell people that some people once thought creation was important. Hey, this is bizarre. Here you have the Council of Europe starting a resolution by saying that creation, as a matter of religious belief, for some people, gives a meaning to life. Yes, and by the way, gave birth to the European culture and civilization of which the Council of Europe is supposedly the defender. It's an amazing statement. It's almost breathtaking in its audacity. It's amazing because it reflects the fact that they just obviously believe they've got to tell people why the issue's even important. Some people think creation's important, so maybe you should too. And if you're not careful, that's their very words, is if you're not careful, creationism could become a threat to human rights, which are a key concern of the Council of Europe. As I said in my article, someone must be passing out paranoia pills there in Strasbourg, France. Can you just imagine that here you had the leading human rights body of all of Europe assign the task of enforcing the decisions of the Court of Human Rights, the group that's supposed to hold European nations accountable for human rights, actually spent its deliberative energies arguing about the danger of creationism. Now, let me read to you a little more from this. This is from the text of their resolution. Creationists question the scientific character of certain items of knowledge and argue that the theory of evolution is only one interpretation among others. They accuse scientists of not providing enough evidence to establish the theory of evolution as scientifically valid. On the contrary, they defend their own statements as scientific. None of this stands up to objective analysis. Now, that's the end quote. But let's just ask the question, well, where's the objective analysis? I mean, you just said in your resolution it won't stand up. Well, where? I mean, you know, provide some evidence. All they do is make assertions. It follows. They say that creationists, quote, question the scientific character of certain items of knowledge. You know, you heard that. Then they say, We are witnessing a growth of modes of thought which, the better to impose religious dogma, are attacking the very core of the knowledge that we have patiently built up on nature, evolution, our origins, and our place in the universe. Now, that's truly scary to me. I mean, honestly, here you have the Council of Europe saying that they, and I guess by that they mean by that Western civilization, maybe even just in particular European cultures, have built up a core of knowledge that has been patiently built up on, get this, nature, evolution, our origins, and our place in the universe. Now, explain to me exactly how we are to be encouraged by the fact that evolution supposedly tells us our place in the universe. What would evolution tell us our place in the universe is? Alone? Meaningless? Futureless? Naturalistic? Purely material? Where in the world's hoping that? Is the Council of Europe celebrating the fact that whatever knowledge they supposedly built up from evolution is going to tell them their place in the universe? They went on. The Assembly has constantly insisted that science is of fundamental importance. Science has made possible considerable improvements in living and working conditions and is a not insignificant factor in economic, technological, and social development. Now, listen to these words. The theory of evolution has nothing to do with divine revelation, but is built on facts. End quote. Now, that is such a simplistic view of science that it would make the most ardent evolutionist blush. You know, certainly they want to point to evidence for evolution. The evolutionary theorists, the proponents of the theory, are going to try to point to patterns and evidences. But even the most arrogant of them wouldn't say it's simply a matter of facts. Like all of a sudden you open a box and out jump the fact of evolution. Or like you can take all these fossils that Senator Clinton was talking about looking at and somehow just weave them together into the fact of evolution. That is an amazing sentence. But the group, that is, the Council of Europe's commitment to naturalistic evolution is unconditional. They say this, evolution is not simply a matter of the evolution of humans and populations. Listen to this. Denying it could have serious consequences for the development of our societies. In other words, evolutionary theory is now so important to our secular societies here in Europe that if it is undermined in any way, compromised to any degree, it could impede the progress of our civilization. There's so much more here. I'm going to read to you from the resolution. Our modern world is based on a long history of which the development of science and technology forms an important part. However, the scientific approach is still not well understood, and this is liable to encourage the development of all manner of fundamentalism and extremism. Let me just stop there. When you don't like something, and you're a haughty liberal secularist, you just come up with the very convenient labels, extremism and fundamentalism. Even though they're describing what certainly their parents and grandparents believed. They're talking about the beliefs that gave birth and structure to the very civilization they're supposedly trying to protect. Well, they call it fundamentalism and extremism. They say the total rejection of science is definitely one of the most serious threats to human rights and civic rights. So in other words, if you believe in creation, that's tantamount to, quote, the total rejection of science. You know, they might be interested to know that creationists go to hospitals. That creationists believe in, you know, certain patterns of predictable weather, that creationists believe in the second law of thermodynamics and in the law of gravity. It's just a complete slander to say that if you believe in the divine creation of the universe and you do not buy into the theory of evolution, that that represents the total rejection of science. They go on. The war on the theory of evolution and on its proponents most often originates in forms of religious extremism, there that is again, which are closely allied to extreme right-wing political movements. The creationist movements possess real political power. The fact of the matter, and this has been exposed on several occasions, is that some of the advocates of strict creationism are out to replace democracy by theocracy. There you have it. Let's put all those words in as close a proximity as possible. Fundamentalism, extremism, theocracy. Folks, this isn't an argument. This is a propaganda piece adopted by the Council of Europe in order to situate evolution in the secular mind is absolutely necessary to human progress and human dignity. I want to know what you think about it. The phone number is 877-893-8255. It's Europe now. How long before something like that here? The phone number 877-893-TALK. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
best of the Albert Mueller Program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Well, you heard for yourself a good bit of the portion of this resolution adopted by the Council of Europe. It truly is breathtaking stuff. Here you have the European body, the highest body related to human rights, declaring that creationism is a threat to human rights, to democracy, and that it is rooted in extremism, fundamentalism, and a desire to establish a theocracy, and that it threatens the forward progress of civilization, no less. You know, I'm doing this program from Kentucky. Here in Kentucky, there's the Creation Museum. It's attracting an incredible amount of attention there in the area around Cincinnati, very close to the Cincinnati airport. It's getting world attention. I've been called by reporters all over the world saying, you know, what does this mean? And it's just absolutely incredible to them. The secular world is shaking at its foundations because their firm belief in evolution just isn't winning the day among the general public. And it's driving him nuts. Even in Europe, that's the amazing thing. Even in secular Europe, it's like they're hearing the hoofbeats of the creationists coming, which, by the way, they acknowledge are not only made up of Christians, but also in their context of Muslims. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. In Louisville, Kentucky, Alan's listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Alan.
Dr. Mueller, I agree with the statement that you made. It is creationism is against their society, the society that they have painstakingly built over the last several hundred years with evolutionism, and they see that as a threat, and they want to take creationism or the Christian worldview right out of society because it doesn't go with their plan with society as they have slowly progressed over the last several years.
You know, you're absolutely right, Alan. I want to ask you a follow-up question on that, though. Are you surprised by just the bald, naked candor of what they have to say here?
Not at all. I've watched and tried to keep abreast of worldview and different events around the world, and it just more and more seeing society as a closed-minded society, that all Christians and those who believe in God are extremists, and that they should be rid of society.
You know, another interesting thing about this statement is that clearly they're not fearing a backlash in European countries to this. You know, there might be someone out in the hinterlands, I guess, that might complain, but they obviously do not expect a great political backlash on this because they've offered basically no defense for their argument. Appreciate your call, Alan. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. In Jacksonville, Florida, David's on the line. Go ahead, David.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. What's so interesting is that from a European standpoint, you start looking back at the greatest scientific advantages and things that have been brought back by science are the great theologians. I mean, Sir Isaac Newton, Louis Pasteur, and all these great scientists, they probably wrote more and read more and believed in strong biblical belief, and also they had scientific basis. If you throw out science, you throw out our great scientists. And that's what really blows my mind, that they forget about their history.
You know, good point, David. And I think as you look forward in history, and you mentioned some of the greatest scientific minds, certainly Sir Isaac Newton, no doubt about that, a Christian civilization gave birth. It was itself the cradle of the scientific revolution. H.W. Butterfield, the great historian of science, points out that the Christian worldview dignified the world, the earth, as God's creation in such a way that it was a proper object to study. And furthermore, the Christian scriptures taught that the world is intelligible, that it's orderly because it's created by an orderly God, and it's understandable because God means to be glorified by our observation of this world. Therefore, Butterfield said that's why the modern scientific revolution took place in the Christian civilization as its cradle rather than somewhere else in the world. Now, as you look forward in history, though, you do see a diverging set of paths. One path taken by science because it absorbed into its own methodology, many scientists and much of science, an explicitly naturalistic worldview. And when science did this at first, they said, we're going to bracket the supernatural. We're not going to deny it. We're simply going to bracket it. But that didn't last long, until you got to the denial of the supernatural. So now you have evolutionists like Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett who are very bold to say, look, you know, people can play at theistic evolution and they can they can try to suggest that there is a reconciliation possible between evolution and Christianity. But at the end of the day, there isn't. And evolution, which they believe to be firmly true, unquestionably true, means that there is no inherent meaning in human life other than the meaning we make. There is no idea more antithetical to Christianity than that. The phone number is 877-893-8255, coast to coast and with listeners around the world. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
Okay, folks, this is the way it works. Every single worldview has to answer the question of origins. You can't get around it. It is the question that screams for attention. It demands to be answered. It's the way the ancients used to put it. Why is there something rather than nothing? The very existence of the world, the existence of ourselves, requires some explanation. We want to know, how did this happen? How did we get here? What does it mean? And let's face it, the question of how we got here is the question of what it means. That's what you can't get around. Evolution is not merely a scientific theory. It is an implication about the meaning of life. It's either a naturalistic accident or it's something else. And, of course, as Christians, we believe that something else is that it was the purpose of creation of a holy God who created the world for his glory. The meaning and destiny of human life is completely different if you follow those two worldviews out to their conclusion. Now, we understand that. What's interesting is that the Council of Europe also understands that. Now, what's further interesting is that they have decided to take sides in the matter. And the side they have taken is on behalf of naturalistic evolutionary theory. They are absolutely determined to defend it. They see creationism. And in Europe, by the way, there just isn't much creationism to be found. It's not like there are mass movements. In the United States, we've had major federal court cases over creationism. We've had state boards pass laws about creationism, some favoring the inclusion of creationism in public schools. We've had intelligent design emerge as a major movement of cultural conversation here in the United States. But in Britain and in Europe, that's mostly unknown. It's not as if there is some actual, literal, current, credible threat to the reign of evolutionary theory and Darwinian philosophy in the European educational systems. But even without a credible threat, the very fact that there are some people in their midst, and perhaps even more people in their midst, who believe in creation, who believe that evolution is a faulty theory, this is scaring them to death. I want to point out, by the way, that one of the reasons why they may feel insecure in this is simply by numbers. Because the people most committed to evolution are those that are most secular, and they're those that are most European, and they're the ones who are having the least children. So the people having the most children are the people more likely to believe in divine creation. Therefore, they will eventually, let's put it this way, the creationists will outnumber the evolutionists in terms of reproduction, if you just look at the cultural left versus the cultural right. The other thing is that Europe really has a very significant problem of the threat of Islam. And there are certainly Islamic forms of creationism, an Islamic form of anti-Darwinianism that is the concern of these people. And so they look at it, they just conflate it, make it one thing, and say anyone that doesn't buy into evolution must be rooted in fundamentalism or extremism and must be wanting to establish a theocracy. That's nonsense, of course. The historical amnesia here is pretty pitiful. There's no acknowledgement that those who created the very European civilization in which they are a part believed in the divine creation of the universe. There's no credence whatsoever given to the fact that vast numbers of people, probably, almost assuredly, the majority of people on the planet right now believe in divine creationism of one sort or another and aren't buying into the Darwinian myth. That reminds me of what a New York Times columnist did a couple years ago in writing, saying, I worry about this country because 70% of Americans, according to some polls, say that they deny the Darwinian model of evolution. That just scares people to death because every worldview has to have a story of beginning. And when that story of beginning comes, when they develop it, it's going to point not only to the beginning, but to the end. Because the end is always found in the beginning. That's the way it is in the scripture. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. How is the end of the story in that beginning? It's because if in the beginning, God is Lord and King and sovereign, in the end, he will be King and Lord and sovereign as well. If in the beginning, There was nothing but the primordial ooh and ooze, and there was nothing but time and space and energy, and of course they have no explanation actually for anything got started. Then you're, and how you got something out of nothing, that's still the great philosophical question evolutionary theory can't answer. They nonetheless come up with a system of thought in order to say that you don't have to worry about the fact that there's a God who created you and created all things in an orderly fashion and who is in control and who might actually judge you. You just trust that there is a blind scientific process known as evolution, and you simply trust that we know what we're talking about when we say that evolution is the only credible theory. Lots of fascinating stuff that is found in this resolution adopted last week by the Council of Europe. But one of the things that I found most interesting is how they decide to discriminate now among religious faiths and among Christian denominations and styles of theology by saying this, quote, all leading representatives of the main monotheistic religions have adopted a much more moderate attitude, end quote. Now, what they mean by that moderate attitude is that, by their claim, all the respectable faiths have found a way to accommodate themselves to Darwinism. Now, that's true of theological liberalism. As a matter of fact, many theological liberals have tried to embrace a form of evolutionary theory within their theological scheme in order to show that even God himself is evolving. The classic heresy of process theology is the fact that God is himself developing. He's evolving along with his creation. So that's certainly true that they have found a way to accommodate themselves to evolutionary theory. I meet people all the time who say, I'm a Christian and I believe that God directed the process of evolution. Well, guess what? If you believe in the process of evolution, it denies that there's any direction. You can't coherently hold to the prevailing model of Darwinian or the prevailing model of evolutionary theory and to the fact that there is a sovereign God who is leading and guiding the process, because the very core of the modern theory is that there is no guidance to the process. Lots of interesting stuff here when you start looking at it. But the bottom line is that the worldview chasm is here exposed. The chasm between a Christian worldview that roots everything, well, in those three words, in the beginning God. That's four words. Those four words, in the beginning God, and in the beginning nothing that became something. You put those two worldviews over against each other, and then you have the great chasm. Now, where is the insecurity here? That's the interesting thing I want to ask. Where is the insecurity here? I want to suggest to you that this article, this resolution, this development is further evidence that the insecurity is on the side of the Darwinians. What they're looking for is the high priesthood of science, and they don't want anyone to question the absolute primacy and infallibility of the priesthood of the scientists. And yet the one thing science can't answer is the most ultimate question of all. Why is there something rather than nothing? And since there is something, what does it mean? Where is it going? How do we understand it? This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation, and this is one of those developments that demands our attention because it shows us that even as we must answer the question, why is there something rather than nothing, everyone else must too. And how you answer that question ends up basically defining everything important about you. Back with final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Well, folks, as you were listening to that conversation, I hope you were having the thought, you know, you just never know what you're going to hear next. If people will accuse folks who believe in creationism of being a threat to human rights, I mean, it's hard to believe where you go from there. It's just a reminder to us, and this is, I think, the point. When I re-listened to that conversation with you, I think the most amazing thing for me to reflect upon is how desperate the evolutionists are becoming, how concerned they are, almost paranoid they are about the existence of people by large numbers, by the millions in America, who do not buy into the theory of evolution. Not only that, they are particularly vexed by the fact that as most Americans look at the world, they are absolutely convinced that it is the product of some intelligent creator. In other words, the world is implausible. The cosmos doesn't make sense unless there was a creator who intentionally made it as it is. When you start looking at the central argument of evolutionary theory, certainly the dominant form of the theory as it's found in the academy today, you come face to face with the fact that the alternatives are stark and they're irreconcilable. Either you believe in a form of the origin of the universe that is entirely materialistic and naturalistic, that has absolutely no room whatsoever for supernatural intervention, or on the other side, you believe that there was a supernatural creator who formed and fashioned the world, who created all things for his own purposes and by his own design. Now, of course, we as Christians believe a lot more than merely that. We believe that there's a loving, intelligent, omnipotent, omniscient creator who created the entire cosmos for his glory. We believe more than merely that there was a supernatural designer. But it's really interesting that those are the alternatives. You're either going to believe in a supernatural, and this is it, isn't it? Or a non-supernatural account of the cosmos. But, you know, if you're going to buy into a non-supernatural account of the entire cosmos, then that means, and let's face this very clearly, you have to have a non-supernatural analysis and understanding of every moment of life. In other words, if you're going to exclude the supernatural from the creation of the cosmos, then if you're going to be even halfway intellectually consistent, you're going to have to exclude the supernatural from every other dimension of your life. Now, the fact is that even a lot of those who claim they believe in evolution can't go all the way. And that's the other fascinating to think about this. The other fascinating aspect is that even the evolutionists, well, the vast majority of them simply can't go even the whole way. That's why, interestingly enough, last year at the end of the year, we covered a news story that reported that even some of the world's leading evolutionary atheists announced they were going to celebrate Christmas. You know, you just can't get away from it. But if you indeed are going to take evolution to its logical conclusion, if you're going to be absolutely committed to naturalism and materialism, then you got to buy the whole worldview. And if you do, then, well, you heard it today, you're going to consider those who won't go with you, those who believe in a supernatural creator and would teach their own children the divine creation of the world, you're going to consider them a threat to civilization, a threat to human rights, and all the rest. I'll meet you next week for Intelligent Christian Conversation. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.